Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Alzheimer's disease, the hushed nightmare version of old age, is on the wrong side of the medical news again. The headline shocker this month was that the watchdog Food and Drug Administration had approved an anti-Alzheimer's drug from the pharma giant Biogen. The treatment, called aducanumab, has no record of success and a first-round price tag per patient of $55,000 per year. Our keynote guest, Aaron Kesselheim, has the inside story of the FDA's retreat from regulation. Then Jason Karlowish will join us from the front line of Alzheimer's treatment. The riddle this hour is what makes the last stage of human life so demanding and so difficult. Dr. Kesselheim, Boston internist, researcher, and writer, you're a player in the telltale parable this summer of how the war on Alzheimer's went wrong. Surely it looks that way when the FDA greenlights a no-effect drug at an unthinkable price. You called it a low point in the FDA's retreat from regulation, and you quit the advisory committee that voted no, almost unanimously, on this treatment called aducanumab. How low is low, and how worried should we be?
Well, I think we should be worried because, you know, I think that this decision was a problematic decision on a lot of different levels. First of all, as you pointed out, the clinical trials that we require companies to do to show that their drug works did not show any convincing evidence that this drug worked. At the best, it provided a signal that there might be some effectiveness, but that should be the basis of further testing. And you know, there is a lot of conflicting evidence that suggests that the drug just doesn't work. When you add in the fact that this drug causes substantial side effects and, you know, is associated with risks of brain swelling and bleeding in about a third of the patients who take it, I think that all adds up to a very problematic decision.
It's strange that in COVID time, we were getting to know something about the safe and effective standards of FDA approval. Also, with the quick production of a COVID vaccine just in time this year, we were coming to believe in real medical miracles again. I mean, how strange was that decision, and public and notorious now?
Well, I think that the decision is an important one because it suggests the level of evidence that the FDA might require for certain treatments. I think one of the great things about the FDA's decision-making around the COVID vaccines is that the FDA required a relatively high level of evidence around the COVID vaccines. And so when those vaccines came to market, even though they came to market so fast, they came to market with a substantial amount of evidence behind them that allowed us to feel confident that they would work and be effective when we take them. And in fact, that's what we found. And unfortunately, in this case, the FDA went in the other direction and approved this drug on the basis of extremely limited evidence. And, you know, unfortunately, that might set a precedent for how the FDA might handle other similar drugs. And then, you know, I think that if we have a whole bunch of drugs that have no evidence that they work and are available at very high prices, I think that puts patients, you know, and the healthcare system in a very untenable situation.
Aaron, I wondered if the underlying story here was that medical science and government authority had somehow, without saying it, given up on Alzheimer's disease, what had been called 40 years ago the disease of the century. But they punted on this one, it sounds to me.
For decades now, there has been a lot of research and a lot of good scientists have been working on trying to treat Alzheimer's disease. And the main way that they've been doing that is through what's called the amyloid hypothesis, thinking that these amyloid plaques might be responsible in part for the Alzheimer's disease, and so reducing them might be helpful. And unfortunately, as I mentioned, dozens of different therapies have been tried that have targeted these amyloid plaques, and none of them have shown any impact on the course of the disease. And it seemed to me that we maybe should be looking at other targets or other modalities to try to treat Alzheimer's disease, that the field, you know, should be looking at other hypotheses or premises for how to treat this condition. And what this approval in this aducanumab case does is it validates you know, drugs that reduce amyloid plaque, but there's no good evidence that drugs that do that will improve the course of patients' cognitive function.
My guess would have been that the condemnation and your resignation around the FDA's approval process would have killed aducanumab. Among other things, it would have cost people a king's ransom for minimal relief. And the FDA hasn't apparently reconsidered. I mean, will that treatment come to market at $55,000 a year? And will Medicaid come to cover it? I mean, for a million Alzheimer's patients in the U.S., the bill would be $55 billion a year. And in fact, there are said to be 5 million Americans affected by Alzheimer's. Will this thing stand, is what I'm asking.
Well, not only will it stand, but my understanding is that Biogen has already started shipping the product out and patients have started begun treatment with it. So I think that the decision is going to stand, but I do think that this does put a lot of pressure on the healthcare system and, you know, whether Medicare is going to pay for it and on physicians and patients in deciding whether or not to use this product. I think another major issue that this case brings up is it points to the fact that in the United States, we basically allow companies to set whatever price they want for their new drugs. And as a result of that, the company that makes this drug can set a sky-high price, and it can be assured that our government payers are going to cover the and pay for the drug at that price. Now, it's possible that our government payers may take a stand and try to put limitations on patients who qualify for this drug or some other limitations on it. Those kinds of stands would be very rare. It's very rare that the government does that. And even so, as you mentioned, there are so many people with Alzheimer's disease that even if this drug is used in a minority of those patients, it will still cause important potential financial strains on the healthcare system.
Aaron, you've invoked the awful memory of thalidomide back in the early 60s that led, especially in England and elsewhere, to terribly deformed babies. That's the nightmare. How close are we to that kind of sort of blind deregulation? You said we need a new organization to review drug approvals, but is it anywhere on the horizon?
The reason that thalidomide is important is because the thalidomide tragedy in the 1950s and early 60s was what inspired the rules in the first place that gave us the authority to give the FDA the power to require companies to test their drugs to prove that they work before they went into the general use. You know, unfortunately, if we chip away at those rules in enough instances, then we'll find ourselves in a position where there will be a lot of drugs on the market that don't have good evidence that they work. In other countries, actually, this is quite routine for what are called health technology assessment organizations to review drugs that have been approved by the regulator and make determinations about how effective those drugs are compared to other drugs that are available to provide guidance for physicians and patients and the healthcare system to determine whether or not these drugs should be used, and if they should be used, what a fair price for these drugs should be. So what I was suggesting was that it might be useful to have a similar organization in the United States that takes drugs that are approved by the FDA and evaluates their effectiveness and determines where they fit into the armamentarium that physicians have to treat their patients.
Aducanumab is getting all the ink, but in fact, it's only one of any number of experiments toward drug treatments and others. Put it in the context of what else is going on in research world about Alzheimer's.
There has been, particularly in recent years, you know, a lot of additional resources put into study of Alzheimer's and other nervous system diseases. You know, I think that there is a lot of good research and a lot of good science that's going on right now to try to figure out new strategies. And I think that approving a drug like aducanumab, when it isn't clear that the drug works, doesn't send a good signal to those researchers and isn't providing the same kind of incentive to those researchers to find something that does work really well that would meet reasonable standards of effectiveness, but instead might allow companies to fall back on drugs that are known to reduce amyloid, but you know may not have any clear effect on the treatment of the disease that they might have shelved in past years.
We're going to be talking about other approaches to Alzheimer's other than pills, but are there other more promising pills and chemical treatments that you would cite as the hope?
I don't know that I necessarily want to pick out any particular products. There are excellent research centers around the country that are working on this disease and are working on other pathways. And again, I think the important thing is that if the FDA maintains reasonable standards, then all of those scientists are similarly incentivized to try to develop treatments for this disease that actually have good evidence behind them. And what we can't do is we can't provide workarounds or backdoors for products to get on the market, because that will then undermine the incentives to invest in all of these other potential areas that might provide even better treatments in the future.
The approval of aducanumab became a sort of lesson in the meaning of that phrase, cherry picking for data. Do you want to illustrate what the objections were in that case?
I think part of the concern and part of the questions around aducanumab's usefulness is that the company manufacturing aducanumab, to its credit, set up two very complicated and rigorous trials. And those trials, when they were analyzed about halfway through, the company showed that the drug didn't work. And so the trials were stopped. And then ultimately, as the company was kind of wrapping up these trials and some more data came in, the company went back and reanalyzed the data and found that there was a signal that in one of the arms, in one of the trials, that there was a statistically significant effect on a reduction in the function, in the cognitive function. And then the company then went back with the FDA to reanalyze the data and try to understand why that signal was the right signal and all of the other data out there was not right. And that kind of post hoc rationalizing is an important effort and can help provide hypotheses for subsequent research, but it's not something that you should base a final decision on, because there is a concern that for whatever reason, picking the outcome that you want and saying that that's the good one and trying to explain away the bad outcomes may lead to biases in how you interpret the data. And so that kind of an exercise is a great exercise to try to set up future hypotheses, but it isn't something that we should be basing drug approval on.
Aaron Kesselheim, thank you for staying on the case with aducanumab. It's beginning to just trip off the tongue, that name, but we want to talk to you again about the larger picture of Alzheimer's in this time. Thank you. Don't go away. Coming up, the education of an Alzheimer's doctor. This is Open Source. Jason Karlovich at the University of Pennsylvania, you got your education as a doctor in the medical care of patients and families suffering cognitive impairment, on the way sometimes to dementia, sometimes to diagnoses of Alzheimer's disease. There's a century of history in your 25-year career, a lot of it fruitless research, frustrated hope. In your, I must say, beautifully written book called The Problem of Alzheimer's, you write about how science, culture, and politics turned a rare disease into a crisis and what we can do about it. Start in the now, including the regulatory snafu. How did we get to what feels like a dead end with Alzheimer's in aducanumab?
What's happened with aducanumab reveals a larger problem that haunts Alzheimer's disease and has haunted Alzheimer's since 1980s or so. And that is that a disease in America doesn't really fully exist until it has a business model.
Wow.
That's been a problem with this disease, namely the ability for the millions of people with it, as well as their family members, to get the diagnosis and care they need has been a series of just constant frustrations. And that pretty much means some sort of pharmaceutical therapeutic for which you can at least break even, if not make money. And Alzheimer's hasn't had that until aducanumab, and yet, of course, aducanumab has all the problems that Dr. Kesselheim has detailed.
A remedy needs a business model. In the case of Alzheimer's, it also needs a definition between a disease or perhaps a natural feature of human life.
Right.
That you can't run fast in your 90s, and you can lose your teeth, and you can lose your memory, and you can lose more than that. What's the risk of treating a universal decline in old age as a disease? And what was the choice historically through the 20th century?
So the story for a brief period in the early 20th century, and then a dark age has descended, and then at the end of the 20th century, was a recognition that losing your ability to self-determine your life in old age was something that we didn't desire. In other words, we don't want to lose our autonomy. We don't want to lose our ability to decide how we want to live and then enact the daily activities to do that. Pick a restaurant, go to the restaurant, order off of it and pay the bill, for example. Where science then stepped in and said, you know, the thing that we've been calling senility, actually, there's a biological basis to what's going on there. And so what happened was a rare disease, Alzheimer's, that is to say a problem that was only seen in sort of middle-aged people and therefore considered rare, suddenly was able to be redefined as a very prevalent disease, namely the cause of what had been thought of just extreme, unfortunate stage of aging, that is senility. And I don't have a problem with that union of a biological explanation for something that is undesirable. I mean, I don't want to be profoundly disabled in my ability to self-determine my life.
Nor I.
Yeah, so I don't have a problem with transforming senility into Alzheimer's because the biology is solid and the suffering is real. And just because it's common and universal doesn't make it, quote, normal. I mean, presbycusis is common and nearly universal, you know, loss of hearing, especially loss of vision, reading vision, and yet we get glasses. I mean, we could run down a host of things that occur in aging, and just because they're very common, ought not to say, therefore, we should, quote, tolerate them. But I think the issue is, if you use a disease model to approach that problem, which is what we've chose to do with the problem of dementia, then we have to take on, you know, the medical model, which is diagnosis, treatment, using the medical system, healthcare system, and of course, research. And there, the Alzheimer's field has made progress, but also has faced enormous challenges in all those three areas.
We called it Alzheimer's in honor of a German doctor in Franconia at a peak sort of 1910. What was Dr. Alzheimer's contribution to our understanding today, and how many ways did it get derailed?
Alois Alzheimer's was a psychiatrist. He was very revolutionary in his thinking, although he wasn't very revolutionary in his acting. He was a very middle-class fellow, liked his beer, and, you know, nice guy. But he and his other all-German, German national, German-speaking psychiatrists and were a very unique group. And I bring them up that they were German for two reasons. Number one, the kind of work they did was really only being done in Germany. And it was meticulous clinical descriptions and pathologic examination of their patients' brains. Patients, of course, at autopsy in order to get their brain. And the work they were doing in the early 1900s was really quite revolutionary. Namely, they were beginning to say, we think these people who have senility, there's something going on in their brains that isn't just extreme aging. And they were really making spectacular progress. But again, I mentioned they were German, and that matters because everything was going pretty well up until about 1914. And then things kind of went bad very quickly and very, very notably. So that by 1918, of course, Germany was a wreck. You know, they lost the World War. And the remaining years that would follow would just be years, decades of social, political, and economic unrest, culminating, of course, in the Nazi era. And it wrecked German science. It really did. It wrecked their research. Had they been able to continue with what they were doing, it's quite possible that they really would have done some of the work that really we didn't pick up with until about 1990 in America. So the story of Alzheimer's in the 20th century is really a story of science being kind of wrecked by social, political, and economic problems.
But you also argue that the Freudian revolution between the wars,
yes,
revolution in studying the mind, was all wrong for treatment of Alzheimer's. Explain that.
It wasn't so much all wrong, it just wasn't right. Up until the First World War, Freudian ideas of illness, namely psychodynamic theories of brain illness, really were sort of a fringe area, largely about suppressed psychosexual traumas and whatnot. And then World War I happened, and what World War I did was produced hundreds of thousands of otherwise healthy young men with notable neurologic and psychiatric symptoms as a result of the trauma of World War I. And it really transformed the thinking about brain illness. Namely, there's this whole psychodynamic theory of why people have mental illness, neurologic illness even. And so the biological psychiatry that Alois Alzheimer's and his colleagues were following just didn't really fit that model. Moreover, you know, the promise of the psychodynamic Freudian theory was we have a treatment to offer. After World War II, American psychiatry really ruled, and American psychiatry was enamored of Freudian theories. And so, you know, that approach to mental illness, that approach to diagnosis and treatment dominated the field. And so persons with, at the time, senility just didn't fit because, you know, they weren't amenable to psychodynamic diagnostics and therapeutics largely. And moreover, any sort of focus on, well, there's a biology going on here just wasn't terribly interesting. And so in some sense, dementia just fell into just kind of a neglect for much of the 20th century.
Yeah, Freudian theory seemed to take the biology out of this disease and substitute childhood trauma or childhood history. Is that fair?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the case of senility, at best, senility could be viewed as, you know, extreme aging, vascular disease, degenerative senile processes, and perhaps some sublimated problems. But again, that just didn't interest psychiatry, except when individuals had extreme behavioral problems, in which case psychiatry would step in, you know, with antipsychotics and or other approaches. So yeah, really, dementia was just neglected and ignored for much of the 20th century.
40 years ago was a turning point.
It was, yeah.
Patient families were stirring. And then in the late 1970s, Lewis Thomas, cancer doctor, great essayist on modern medicine, called Alzheimer's the disease of the century. And the strange thing is he said it in a spirit of hope. He also declared Alzheimer's the worst of all diseases for what it does to the patient and his or her family's friends, caretakers. And then what happened?
Well, things got going for a bit. It was really a patient advocacy movement that would form the organization that would come to be called the Alzheimer's Association. And these were, well, families really, not patients. They were all family members, mostly spouses, who were just irate at the quality of care or their lack of care, frankly, that their relatives were receiving, trying to figure out what's wrong. And after figuring out what's wrong, getting treatment. And things got going such that by 1980, they had the attention of the National Institute of Aging. And research funds were starting to flow. But 1980 also was a seminal year in the history of America as well. Namely, it would be the beginning of the Reagan Revolution. And you can almost chart the story of Alzheimer's disease for the remainder of the 20th century as kind of a dialogue of resistance and accommodation, namely a recognition on the national level that this is a problem and we need to do something about it. But at the same time, every policy that was being pushed by the Alzheimer's Association, namely expanding long-term care services and supports with federal support and radically, dramatically increasing the amount of money for research, all that would constantly run up against a government philosophy that stressed small government, deregulation, devolution to the states, no tax increases, etc. And that was not a political climate to expand long-term care services and support or dramatically increase the amount of funding that was needed to do the research. And it was really only until this century, under President Obama, that the amount of money for research was finally proportionately increased to what's needed. And that has been a spectacular progress. But we still, as a society, struggle on the delivery of long-term care services and supports.
I was going to say, post-Reagan, there was a moment a dozen years ago, early Obama time, I'd say, when you heard people around Boston, Cambridge especially, say that this would be the Nixon war on cancer all over again, politics at the highest level. People thought it might well succeed in the same Kendall Square neighborhood of Cambridge and Boston where the Moderna COVID vaccine turned up last spring. What happened to that initiative, that dream?
Well, you know, the early 21st century in Alzheimer's is a very interesting story of the activists, the patient advocates, the Alzheimer's Association, and an organization called Us Against Alzheimer's, kind of transforming from being good not-for-profits to taking on the role of politics with political action committees. And the work they did was actually very impressive. In particular, the Alzheimer's Association really worked in a very thoughtful way with Congress to try and de-emphasize some of the political fights that were going on between left and right, et cetera, and take advantage of more targeted efforts to really substantially increase the amount of money that was being put to the NIH for Alzheimer's research. And I'll give the association credit for really magnificent work. I describe it as a chess game because they went about it with the same strategy that a grandmaster goes after. And the result was a dramatic and sustained increase in the amount of funding that is specific for Alzheimer's disease research under the same kind of unique budgetary mechanisms for cancer. The progress actually in the last several years because of that has really been quite spectacular, which is why I found the aducanumab decision so deeply frustrating because rhetorically, it is true there have been no therapies in the last, say, 20 years for Alzheimer's. Bleak, awful, got to approve something. And yet, the last 3 to 5 years have really seen some very notable progress in our ability to visualize the disease in a living human and measure the effective interventions on the pathology and the clinical expressions of the disease. It is true there hasn't been progress to discover a new treatment that is safe and effective for prescription in the last 20 years. The last few years are such that the progress has been really notable, and the approval of aducanumab, many in the field are very worried, is going to really kind of disrupt that progress and detract from that research and public support for the Alzheimer's movement.
Jason Karlowish, I'm fascinated by your own story, how your experience made you an Alzheimer's doctor, but also the incredible range of stories people tell you on their face, in their histories, through their children. I'm endlessly curious about what made you an Alzheimer's specialist.
Kind of a convergence of a few things. I had this longstanding interest when I was training in medicine and in bioethics and human values, and was a writer.
And a good one, I've got to say.
Well, thank you. I actually was pursuing work to become an intensivist physician at the time. But then a second set of events happened, namely in my family. My grandfather had dementia, not well diagnosed. You know, we family was just sort of figuring it out as we went. Anyway, tragic story short, he fell, broke his hip, went to one of the best academic medical centers in America, got the hip replaced with the titanium replacement, all the latest technology, but within 6 months was dead as a result of all the complications from the poor care he received in the hospital. And that's when I said, you know, America doesn't need more intensivists. It needs more doctors to take care of people like my grandfather. And so I switched to geriatric medicine, and pretty quickly, given my interest in ethics, saw how the problem of dementia, the problem of Alzheimer's, was really the area I wanted to focus in. And that was a decision I made in about 1995, 96, and I've never looked back with regret on that. And I think one of the reasons why I find work as a dementia specialist, as an Alzheimer's doctor, fascinating is it's a very narrative-based field. I mean, the way you understand that someone has cognitive impairment is by asking them very intimate questions, you know, what's a typical day, etc. And out of that, you get a story of the illness talking through their daily life.
Yeah, I'd love to meet one of those patients. Can you introduce a patient or two and the relatives who document how many times the patient asks, is it still Monday?
And it is not just stories of patients, obviously, but of their family members, because, you know, one of the requirements we have in the memory center, which is not at all unique to our center at Penn, is if you come in for an evaluation of your memory problems, you need to come in with someone else. And that someone else, and we use a very crude phrase, excuse me, but we call them the, quote, knowledgeable informant. That's the back office phrase for the person who gives the sort of collateral history to help better understand what's going on in the life of the person with cognitive impairment. Of course, that person often is transformed into a caregiver. And of course, the person with cognitive impairment, if indeed that's what they have, you know, becomes a patient. And then, of course, the question is, what's the disease causing their cognitive impairment? It may be Alzheimer's, it may be other diseases. And in the book, I chronicle the lives of folks who, you know, bring me their stories. They're extremely intimate and vivid and personal. There's a story of Arthur Packle, who, you know, came to me because his wife got a call from the condo association, you know, you haven't paid the bill in 3 months, what's going on? And it got worse from there. Namely, she finds out that he's also made a series of business decisions that have caused him to lose a substantial amount of their hard-earned fortune. The rest becomes an economic disaster for the family, which they recover from and carry on as best they can. But that's just one example of the very vivid personal sufferings that people have because of this disease, the disabling cognitive impairments.
You bring Ronald Reagan back in some very touching ways, including asking somebody, who's that fellow over there talking to Nancy?
Yeah. Ronald Reagan haunts the history of Alzheimer's.
I was going to say.
Yeah, for reasons I mentioned already, you know, 1980s, the Reagan administration, they didn't go after Alzheimer's, but certainly the policies they pursued were a real frustration to try and advance the cause of the Alzheimer's Association to improve care and research. But Reagan haunts the disease as well because, of course, he himself got the disease. And his story reveals some of the sort of ground zero challenges, moral challenges of the disease. The narrative you recount was in Larry Altman's story about Reagan's twilight years, was in the New York Times. Reagan was, of course, by then, you know, living at home with Nancy in California with Alzheimer's. He had told America that he had the disease, very poignant disclosure of his diagnosis. And years to follow, he's visited by George Shultz, his former Secretary of State, and his nurse recounts how Reagan asked the nurse, you know, who is that man over there? He looks very famous. And of course, it was George Shultz. He had forgotten who George Shultz was.
Story is told of Ralph Waldo Emerson in his very old age asking his wife, who was that young friend of mine? And she said, that was Henry David Thoreau, Waldo.
Yeah.
But there's also a very touching story on the matter of stigma of Alzheimer's, that Reagan's ambassador to England, the great newspaper publisher, Walter Annenberg, said he didn't want to see Ronald Reagan anymore. He remembered him in his active prime, and that was the Reagan that he would take away.
Yeah, I'll give Ambassador Annenberg the credit for being candid. It's sad what he said, but what he said isn't uncommon, sadly. What Annenberg said was an expression of what's called public stigma. Public stigma is, I know something about you, and because of that, I'm going to distance myself from you. I'm going to avoid you. And so that's what Annenberg was saying. Reagan has Alzheimer's, and I want to remember him as a vigorous fellow. I don't want to be around him the way he is now, disabled by cognitive impairments, and so I'm going to, quote, stay away from him. But of course, in doing that, he wasn't just distancing himself from his former boss. He was distancing himself from Ronald Reagan's wife, Nancy. And the caregivers will describe this as well, that friends and family start to disappear and peel away. That's public stigma. It haunts this disease. And of course, there are other stigmas, namely self-stigma. People with the disease feel that others are going to treat them differently, and so they hide the diagnosis. They feel less of themselves and their skills. And if there's one thing that we have to figure out as a society to combat, and it is the stigmas that haunt this disease. And there's a real need for kind of a cultural cure that surrounds this disease. It's not just drugs that are going to solve that. It really does require culture.
Coming up, from care to cure of Alzheimer's. Between them is the Memory Center. This is Open Source. Jason Karlowish, in his book, The Problem of Alzheimer's, writes about frustration on the cure track, rays of light on the care track. He is a two-track doctor by now.
Well, there are things we can do right now in America to improve the care of persons living with Alzheimer's disease and other diseases that cause dementia. We may not be able to right now effectively treat Alzheimer's disease. You know, the FDA has made clear, actually, in other studies needed to verify whether the drug is beneficial, which is what should have been done, never mind marketing it as well. But setting that aside, there are things we can do right now in America to improve the lives of persons living with dementia. We can create and should create a system of memory centers to improve diagnosis and treatment.
You mentioned the Memory Center at Penn in Philadelphia. Who invented that, and what does it do?
The Penn Memory Center is a unique place. It's a unique place because we have double the number of chairs, because for every patient, they bring in a family member. I jest only partly, because it's about bringing together a multidisciplinary team of psychiatrists, neurologists, and geriatricians, a clinical psychologist, social workers, nurse, a physician's assistant, and psychometric testers. Our mission is to deliver state-of-the-art diagnostics to figure out what's causing your cognitive problem, and then therapeutics, namely care. We have a very close collaboration between the physician and social work team to educate the family about what's the cause of the cognitive impairment, what are the disabilities, how to address them, and how to plan for the future. This ought to be standard of care. Unfortunately, it's not. And sadly, a very poignant point, our social work team is not made possible by clinical revenue. If we relied on clinical revenue, this gets back to the point of the business model issue, we couldn't have that team. The reason why we have that team is because a philanthropist who benefited from our work saw how important it was and said, I want to make this available for everyone who needs it. And so he's given us a generous donation to support that team.
Aaron Kesselheim, what's your own experience with memory centers? Speak of the transition in thinking, active research, practice, in care. Not cure.
Memory centers like the one at Penn, and there are groups of specialists at Brigham Women's Hospital where I work as well, and they do a lot of fantastic work trying to do the best for patients. And I think it is a very important point that while we talk about next generation science and monoclonal antibodies and, you know, are we going to be able to reduce amyloid plaque and how does that affect, while we work on that and try to find a good drug treatment, there are so many different ways that we can positively impact the lives of patients with Alzheimer's disease by providing them better care, better support at home, and better supportive care like the kind that Dr. Karlowish was talking about. That usefulness of that kind of work gets lost in all of the discussion around aducanumab, where people are looking for, you know, one kind of monoclonal antibody that'll solve everything. And I think that, you know, even if we were to take Biogen and the science behind aducanumab at its most optimistic and the most positive interpretations of the data, all it does is very, very slightly reduce the progression of the disease. It's not a cure. It doesn't improve the progression of the disease. So even if we take it at the most optimistic, you know, aducanumab is not going to solve Alzheimer's disease. And what we instead need to be doing is working on these other pathways that groups at the Memory Center at Penn and other places are working on.
That's a tough adjustment in this country to give up on the miracle and simply work through the humanity of a disease.
I actually blend cure into care. To me, care can lead to a cure, but it doesn't have to. Look, the reality with this disease, like cancer and heart disease, is we should expect that there will be therapeutics that make a difference in the natural history and slow down the progressive disabilities that persons living with dementia experience. I think that's not an irrational or unscientific plan. But just as with cancer and heart disease, we've made progress. People still die of those diseases. They still suffer notable disabilities. And I think that that's the way we're going to be living with dementia. Some will benefit from therapies. Some will not. Others will maybe spectacularly benefit. But along the way, we don't debate in cancer centers about how much care we should give. We provide our treatments that are pharmacologic, as well as treatments that are psychological and behavioral. And patients with cancer live well. And I think we should have that same sort of approach with this disease and not pit care versus cure, which I just find is a zero-sum game that in the end harms the very people that we're trying to help, which is the patients and their families.
Interesting. But I'm also thinking of just the ways we think about the disease. You know, Alzheimer's has so many different definitions. The disease of the century, Lewis Thomas said. A disease of autonomy, I think you said,
yeah.
Dr. Karlowish. I hear people thinking about it as a disease of the modern American condition. Mainly, first, that we live longer and longer and longer, but also live with our care in the hands of corporate medicine, business plans, as you say, and big pharma, most especially. Is that a fair picture of where we're at?
There's another reason why this is a distinctly modern disease, and that is the transformation in the demography of America and other developed nations, not just the fastest growing groups in the population or persons over 70, 80 years of age, but there's a rapid decline in birth rates. And so you have a sort of shrinkage, if you will, in the family caregiver workforce. But also we have transformations in the way families function now. I mean, the default idea that there shall always be a family member who will serve in the role of caregiver simply is no longer appropriate for a number of reasons. Number one, families are smaller and spread out. But number two, it's culturally and I think ethically inappropriate to think that a family, you know, namely the woman in the family often, that she shall serve in that role. That's why, for example, the role of caregiver is actually a very modern role. If you look before 1980, no one spoke of caregivers. Caregivers were always there. It just was baked into the idea of that's just a private family thing that families take care of. And so in American culture, as in other cultures, thankfully, you know, that isn't just an assumption made. People have the right to self-determine their lives and choose who and how they will be a caregiver. And of course, the problem in America is we've failed to support those caregivers.
You tell so many extraordinary stories about people who prepare statements for their families about when care should end. And then they come to that point and don't want to die, don't want to be released from feeding or intense care. And then you tell a most poignant story at the end of your book about a man who has been years in Alzheimer's, not communicative, and then a last meeting with his granddaughter. Would you tell that and then expand on the moral of the story?
Yeah. So one day in clinic, I was seeing a patient, and the granddaughter was the informant for this patient, her mother, and she was recalling how her grandfather, the patient's father, also had dementia, and was at the very end stage of his disease, in hospice care. They knew he was at the end of things, and you know, she would visit him weekly. He would oftentimes not converse with her, and if he did, it wasn't communication that was terribly coherent in terms of, you know, exchange of information. She often didn't feel he knew who she was, but she would visit him every week. Anyway, he became very ill. He goes to hospital, and she visits him, and she recounts how she walks in the room and he looks at her, and he begins to speak to her clearly and coherently, and he speaks to her about her and his love for her. And when she told me this story, she burst into tears in the clinic. He would then die a few days later. The point I'm getting at is this idea that the person is, quote, no longer there, is just that. It's an idea. And indeed, these episodes of lucidity are actually not at all uncommon over the course of the disease. And I think they're challenging us to think about what's going on in the mind of a person with dementia. And the idea that they're losing their mind, I think, is one that we have to be more critical of and recognize that it's a much more complicated set of events going on there that are about the relationship between the person with dementia and their family member. And that interconnected mind is the way more and more I think about what dementia is. It's a disorder of interconnected minds. And the idea, therefore, that like there's the then self and the now self is upended by that because, for example, that grandfather was right then and there expressing his then self in his now self. And so I'm trying to get us to broaden our thinking beyond this just metaphors of, and I'll use a strong word that I don't like and I don't use, but I'll use it anyway, that they become zombies. I'm trying to very much push back against that kind of cultural trope as being impoverished and incomplete in how we should understand and think about dementia, and instead to think about new ways of thinking about this problem of the mind.
That's beautifully said. What is it about Alzheimer's in the end that makes treatment and cure so hard, so full of suffering? Maybe it's something about old age itself that is so inexorable.
The revelation I had was maybe 5-6 years ago when I realized this is best understood as a disease of autonomy, a disease of self-determination. It takes away early and relentlessly your ability to exercise your self-determination. That doesn't mean some sort of selfish pursuit. That means the ability to interconnect with others, which is what relational autonomy is all about. And that's why it's so difficult to measure, because how do you measure someone's ability to self-determine their life? That's so intimate and personal, you know, and so multifaceted and splendid. So that's why also the disease is so uniquely devastating and awful, because it's taking away someone's ability to live life's multifaceted, wonderful, intimate ways. And so that's why the disease is so difficult, so uniquely awful, and so bound up in our culture.
Aaron Kesselheim, how does the incredible success of the COVID vaccine, overnight, unexpected, in the spring, how does that condition our thinking about all of these kinds of submicroscopic remedies?
One of the important lessons from the vaccine is that the reason that the vaccine has been so incredibly impressively successful is that the FDA held the company to a reasonable standard for showing that the vaccine worked. There was some discussion early on in the pandemic that maybe a vaccine, you know, would be rushed to market and we could show its effect on some kind of surrogate measure of one kind or other. But the FDA, to its credit, said, no, you know, for a disease and a condition as important as this, we really need some reasonable confidence that the vaccine actually would prevent the disease itself. And instead of bowing to the political pressure at the time to get the vaccine out or the data out, you know, in the days before the election, the FDA appropriately wanted to make sure that the vaccine would actually help people. And in fact, the vaccine does that. And so now you can see the benefits of that, which is that, you know, upwards of 60 to 70% of people at this point are getting vaccinated. And sure, there are some remaining questions that people have about it, and we need to do a better job educating people about the effectiveness and the safety of the vaccine to make sure that everybody can get one. But that, to me, is a great example of why it is that we have the FDA and the systems in place to ensure that products as complicated as vaccines and new drug treatments are tested and held to some reasonable standards before they're widely used.
And if I could follow up on Aaron's point.
Please, Dr. Karlovich.
There's been much talk surrounding the FDA's decision on aducanumab of two emotions, hope and desperation. Folks are desperate, and this gives them hope, these two hidebound emotions. And what Aaron's point, I think, brings up is there's been missing conversation about a very important third emotion, and that's trust. What the FDA did around COVID gave us trust in the system so that when those vaccines came out, we were willing to take them. Never underestimate the value of trust in the processes of science, because where trust isn't there, no amount of desperation and hope are going to be satiated. And that's what has me particularly bothered about the aducanumab decision. It threatens trust in the agency.
Doctors Karlowish and Kesselheim, we're also living through a wild hopes of a CRISPR revolution, editing genes and genomes to repair flaws in human architecture. What's the connection there with the future of Alzheimer's disease?
Well, scientifically, that's an area of not hot pursuit right now in the Alzheimer's space. The genetics of the disease are complicated, and the idea that there's a genetic fix to stop it is certainly on the list of provocative mechanisms, but it's not top of the line right now in terms of what's being pursued for possible treatments.
Does George Church know that? God knows how CRISPR can and will be used, but I'm sure somebody's thinking of the genetic key to Alzheimer's and repairing it.
Oh, yeah. And there certainly have genes have been identified that are associated with developing the disease. None of my remarks should be construed to say that there's no role for CRISPR. I'm saying right now, as we're thinking about mechanisms, CRISPR is not top of the list. Might it be someday? It's possible. And as you are hinting at, CRISPR-based technologies bring with themselves their own set of challenges, because obviously, you know, you're changing the architecture of the genome, which ramifies across the organism, not just on the particular mechanism of disease you're going after.
You spoke of Alzheimer's patients as instances of the extended mind, and you told that beautiful story. I wonder, is there an Alzheimer's story patient that sticks with you, Jason Karlowish, as what we should know and remember?
There's so many, and they have so informed how I kind of think about what is the disease and why it's a disease. A revelation that came to me about Alzheimer's disease is we have to think of Alzheimer's disease and the other diseases that cause dementia as causing disability. And unlike physical disability, the disabilities here are disabilities in thinking and therefore doing activities that require cognition more so than, say, just physical motoric things, not to dismiss the importance of physical and motoric things. But if you've got a physical disability, you correct it using, of course, devices like, you know, a scooter or a ramp, etc. And, you know, the device that helps a person with dementia to be able to function again is another human. We call them the caregiver. We have to think of caregiving in America, caregiving in general, as a morally intense activity. It's just not a series of tasks. Early in my career as a geriatrician, I remember I was taking care of residents on a special care unit, which is a quirky term we have for an area in the nursing home that cares for individuals with advanced dementia. And there was a gentleman who had a beard, and it was a beautifully coiffed Van Dyke beard. I spoke to his wife and asked her, you know, tell me about the beard. And the story she told me was how she grew the beard out. She comes and trims his beard once a week. It's the one activity that she can do with him that A, he seems to enjoy, B, she enjoys doing it for him and with him, and C, it gives him a particular nice look, if you will. He looked very handsome with the Van Dyke beard. And that, I think, as quotidian as the idea of, you know, grooming your husband's beard once a week seems, again, it gets at that very morally intense thing. Because, I mean, she could have just had the beard shaven off. And again, I think that's what makes this disease so fascinating to me as a writer and a doctor, that the stories are very ordinary, but behind them are extraordinary emotions and relationships and ethics. And that's why it's a disease of humanity.
Jason Karlowish, thank you for your book, The Problem of Alzheimer's. Thank you for your work with patients. Thank you for your conversation with us. Aaron Kesselheim, you're the watchdog on the watchdogs, and we thank you for it. And a generous contributor to Open Source, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be on Open Source.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Aaron Kesselheim is professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Jason Karlowish's book is titled The Problem of Alzheimer's. Please think of supporting the hardest working team in radio. You can leave a tip at radioopensource.org or by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you'll find a growing audio library of conversations on all sorts of subjects. Find it at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. Mary McGrath inspires our memory center. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of independent podcasts making some of the smartest audio you'll find anywhere. This week, check out The Briny from host Matt Frasica. His latest episode tells the story of a marathon swimmer getting over a fear of shark attacks. Find that episode at thebriny.net or wherever you get your podcasts. And check out the whole Hub and Spoke lineup at hubspokeaudio.org.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.